There are three things. The first thing is that the Swiss are holding a referendum on Sunday, the 28th of November. So that's this Sunday, a referendum on whether or not they should introduce the COVID pass. So the Doctors for COVID Ethics have put out on their website a message from Sucharit Bhakdi in English, the doctor from Germany, and Catherine Austin Fitz to the Swiss about voting no, the necessity to vote no in this referendum. Because at the moment, lots of other countries are drifting into totalitarianism. And if the Swiss stand up and say en masse, no, we don't want a COVID pass, then that sends a signal, to the
Yeah, but
rest.
surely, I mean, COVID pass or vaccine passport is not totalitarianism. It's basically a medical measure to keep people safe.
Well, no, it doesn't keep people safe because the vaccine doesn't protect anybody from becoming infected or transmitting the virus. They've said this over and over again. So if you hold a pass which says that you are quote unquote clean or whatever, or, healthy, that's false because you could travel anywhere, cough on people, and transmit it to them. Even though you've been given the green tick, the pass to go anywhere. So you're basically allowing unhealthy people to travel and go anywhere with a pass, even though they may actually be contagious. So it isn't. It makes no sense. And I'm going to go into this later because the other thing that I was going to bring up is an interview that was posted on by Rainer Fuhrmann, the German Committee of Investigation. Professor Rainer Fuhrmann, he interviewed recently. There's a video now that he shared of their investigative committee talking to Dr. Ariane Bilharin from France, who is a clinical psychologist and professor of psychopathology. So I was going to go into that as well, because this is, as she describes it, a drift into totalitarianism. And thirdly, this whole business about cases going up, which is, they don't give you any definition of what a case is. What do they mean? Who are these cases? Are they just people who test positive? Does that mean that they're infectious or not? No, it doesn't. It simply is based on this, what we've said over and over again from the very beginning, an erroneous, unreliable PCR test, or even the lateral flow tests, which are unreliable. And so these increased cases mean absolutely nothing under the circumstances. It's
Yeah,
just a
so I mean, for
regular.
example, they might say that in the southwest of England, we've got 10,000 new cases. My question is, are any of them actually sick?
Exactly. They don't clarify that. They don't say that. They don't say who these people are, whether they're sick or not, whether they're in hospital or not, nothing. So it's the same story ginned up over and over again. You'd think by now people will have seen through this entire scam because they keep repeating the same claims ad infinitum. I don't know when people are going to get it. It's quite bonkers. And to add to this insanity, I just saw recently that, and it's only just came to my attention that, well, Hong Kong has an extremely, extremely tight zero COVID policy, which they are, the airline, Hong Kong airline, Cathay Pacific, which used to be one of my favorite airlines, is just gone utterly, well, off the scale, off the charts, insane. Cathay Pacific, all staff and crew have been double jabbed and are apparently aiming to get boosted as well. Despite this, at the beginning of November, one of the pilots of their cargo flights, and majority of Cathay Pacific flights apparently are now cargo flights, because the actual passenger flights have crashed because of the extreme quarantine measures in Hong Kong for inbound travelers. So Cathay Pacific's passenger flights have collapsed to about 10% of their normal passenger rates. So now they're trying to keep from going broke by upping the number of cargo flights they do. So on the 1st of November, apparently, a couple of cargo pilots tested positive after having a layover in Frankfurt. Despite being double jabbed, they tested positive. And then on the 3rd of November, apparently, a further cargo pilot tested positive. Apparently, these three pilots have been sacked for infringing the measures, the Cathay Pacific protocols that they've implemented to prevent infection or whatever. It doesn't say, you know, there's nothing to say whether these cargo pilots were in fact ill. It simply says they tested positive. And on the back of that, all staff and crew and family and contacts of these pilots are having to quarantine. In addition, any pilot or crew that flies into Frankfurt for the rest of the month of November is going to have to isolate and quarantine on return to Hong Kong for 21 days despite testing negative. So there are crew currently isolating or quarantining in a camp in Hong Kong. It's made up of containers stacked on upon each other and laid out in a grid. So you're kept in a kind of, you're basically trapped in a container for 21 days with literally your overnight baggage that you're allowed when you're flying as a crew. So really, it's just incredible that Cathay Pacific flight crews who have been double jabbed and are testing negative are still being required to quarantine for 21 days following the positive tests of three of their pilots at the beginning of this month, for 21 days in a container or at whatever facility. But despite testing negative, repeatedly, daily testing negative, they have to stay. These are healthy people. They have, you know, no signs of illness, and they have to stay in a container, in an isolation room for 21 days. I mean, this is just insane zero COVID policy.
Well, I mean, you could say it's insane, but then we saw nearly one third, between one quarter and one third of the Hong Kong population actually out demonstrating on the streets a couple of years ago. And obviously the Chinese government weren't very happy about that.
No. And I have a friend in Hong Kong currently who was a childhood friend of mine. Yeah, you know, I asked him, I said, do you think this is another attempt to, you know, keep Hong Kong, sort of reduce its strength and its power in the region? Do you think this is a deliberate attack on Hong Kong to keep it sort of subdued? And he said, yes, he thinks it is. But it certainly isn't benefiting Hong Kong's economy. According to my friend, most Americans, Brits, Aussies are flocking out of Hong Kong. They're leaving. They have been leaving in droves since the handover in 97. And according to him, those coming into Hong Kong now, the expat community, are generally from Eastern Europe and Central America. So it's interesting.
It is. Well, I mean, there's a couple more things to say about that, because, of course, the Chinese government is trying to take control of all of the big institutions of Hong Kong. Cathay Pacific is probably one of the most important. So these staff who've been sacked in Frankfurt will almost certainly be instantly replaced by Chinese national staff. trained on other airlines in China. And also, you know, there's no indication as to, again, whether any of these three staff that were sacked in Frankfurt actually were ill. They just had positive tests.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And there's plenty of evidence now that, you know, despite being jabbed, or indeed because of being jabbed, that you're more likely to test positive, because, you know, ONS reports, Office of National Statistics reports, shows market increases in positive cases for those who have been double jabbed. So it could simply be a byproduct of being jabbed, perhaps. Nobody really seems to know. These pilots apparently are challenging the sacking and saying that they did not infringe whatever it was that they are said to have infringed. So it's interesting, but it hasn't been, you know, I was looking for reports about this and I found them on DuckDuckGo. I saw brief mention of it in the Indy and in the Guardian, but really the fact that, you know, these healthy staff and crew are being forced into 3-week long quarantines despite being healthy and testing negative, just because their colleagues 10 days previously tested positive, they probably weren't even in contact, you know. So it's a most bizarre situation.
It seems to me maybe they're using some sort of test and trace thing, saying, well, you know, these people were contaminated and you were in the same room as them or something. But even if you didn't catch anything, that, you know, we're going to have to isolate you too. And this is one of the problems with the test and trace system, which I know has been, you know, in some countries has been extremely strongly enforced, is that you can just get this call saying you've got to isolate, even though there's actually nothing wrong with you at all.
Yeah. And, you know, there's no science behind that whatsoever. I mean, all the science indicates that, you know, this is, I mean, all the myths that started off in the beginning about, you know, whatever you touch, you know, door handles and, you know, anywhere you go, you know, wipe the surfaces down. That's been debunked numerous times. You know, you cannot, this whatever it is, if it is indeed a virus of any sort, is not transmittable via surfaces. You know, the risk of that is absolutely, it's statistically zero. As is, in fact, transmission in a room of people who are infected. So, you know, I think they've done studies now that show your chances of contact or becoming infected, even, you know, within a household of people who test positive and are symptomatic, is something like 17%. You know, it's not even 50%. It's not even 20% chance of becoming infected. And that's living with someone who is infected. So,
well, I mean, surely these respiratory diseases, although they do hang around in the air, you know, it's quite feasible that you can catch them by, I don't know, say, you know, shaking hands with somebody and then using your fingers to eat. You know, you're ingesting it goes into your body, and you know, you can catch it just like you could with, say, I don't know, cholera or a bacteria. You know, the virus is a similar sort of thing, but you seem to be questioning the whole thing of whether a virus exists or not, which surely doesn't help the cause of the doctors who are trying to fight this.
Well, I have to admit that I personally am quite skeptical about virus theory, but, you know, and there are doctors within the group who, within all the whole medical world, there's a, you know, it's shades of gray. You know, people are either extremely convinced and will not, you know, will not deviate from that belief. And then there are those who, you know, are beginning to question. And so there is no consensus Okay, it's just like, in fact, the Church of England. You know, you can go and ask certain heads, religious figures, you know, within the Church of England, and there's shades of belief within the Church itself, whereby some people are adamant that, you know, Jesus was the Son of God, and there are those who actually are beginning to doubt whether, in fact, Jesus was simply a man, or in fact divine.
Look, they're not just beginning in the Church of England, because there was a headline back in the 1970s saying that most vicars don't believe in God. So there you go. There's always been that sort of
heresy in the ranks.
Well, yeah, it's a sort of superficiality to it. So people, and we've had this with doctors too, haven't we? That the idea that you go into the medical profession because you want to help people isn't necessarily the case. Just like you go in to become a vicar, you train because you want to spread the word of God. Isn't the case? A lot of times people do this just for the career and the money.
Well, yes, but I would argue that the ones who genuinely do care are the ones who begin to question the dominant consensus or the dogmas, let's say. For example, I personally know, in fact, my parents in Durham, before my mother passed away in the UK, 6 years ago, my parents eventually began to see a homeopathic doctor, but she had been a GP. She had been a GP for some 35 years, I believe, and really felt that as a GP, she wasn't really helping anybody. She wasn't doing a great deal of benefit. She retrained as a homeopath and carried on practicing homeopathy well into her 80s, and she lived well into her 90s. And there are other doctors like herself, many GPs, I won't say many, but there are considerable number of GPs who go on to train following their qualification as a medical doctor in all types of other alternative therapies and train in nutritional therapy and other types of, study that either complements what they already know or, you know, expands their knowledge to a greater degree. And in fact, many doctors in Turkey, for example, unlike doctors in the UK, many doctors in Turkey, when you go to see them, for instance, with a cancer diagnosis, will advise you, you know, or advise you against, either for or against, eating certain things, and behaving in certain ways. They will give you nutritional advice and lifestyle advice because they are not locked into a sort of diagnostic paradigm where literally they can only give you advice on pharmaceuticals. We've somewhat deviated from what I was saying.
There was a bit of a rabbit hole there, and I apologize for that.
But the virus, this concept about the infectiousness of this virus, I mean, just from personal experience, in the last couple of months, my daughter has come down with the same thing, actually, same symptoms, more or less, in the last 2 months or so. And in the first episode was when she'd gone back to school for the first time in a year and a half, face-to-face education. She'd gone back and was mingling with her classmates. Within the first couple of weeks, she came down with something, and she had a headache, she had a sore throat, and it lasted for a few days, and she ended up having an extremely runny nose, and eventually the symptoms eased and she was fine. We didn't isolate her in her room, as I know some of my normie friends have done in the UK, in particular one friend who actually isolated her son who tested positive. She isolated him in his room for 14 or 10 days, I believe, and he was only allowed out of his room to go to the loo, for example, with gloves and a mask on. Now, anyway, in our case, you know, we continued to hug and cuddle our daughter. We even shared food. We shared drink out of the same bottles. You know, we continued to kiss her on the cheek and so on, and nurse her through her illness, which was very brief and wasn't terribly bad, with, I might add, homeopathy, and she recovered. My husband and myself, we had no symptoms whatsoever. Again, the past weekend, my daughter came home again feeling unwell. She had a sore throat again, very sore throat, in fact. She literally couldn't swallow anything, and it was very uncomfortable. And that has eased, and she's gone back to school, and she's again fine. And we have no symptoms whatsoever. I have no fear of getting anything from her. I do not fear her illness. So I don't know if that's why I'm not affected. But ironically, this friend of mine in the UK, who is like a COVID Nazi, really, in her own family, forcing them to test, forcing all her children to test religiously before they go to school, forcing her kids to wear masks whenever they go out, forcing them into this state, this mental state that there is a dangerous virus all around them at any time, that they are in danger of becoming infected with it. As I say, she forced her son to isolate for 14 days. Oh, sorry, I keep saying 14 days, for 10 days in his room. And there was intense fear that, and the reason that she forced him to isolate, of course, was because there was intense fear that he would infect the rest of the family. What happened after that? Her Facebook posts later revealed that, in fact, all of the family tested positive subsequently, including herself, who at the time was working within the NHS. And so she then had to quarantine. So she quarantined herself in her bedroom for 10 days. And again, only came out wearing a mask and gloves to go to the loo and so on. So, and she's double jabbed, by the way. So you know, it's quite, it's interesting, this psychology of illness. And as well as...
Well, was your friend actually sick?
Yes, she was poorly, was her son. But, you know, the other members of her family tested positive and displayed little to no symptoms. So it must have been a series of isolation in her household for well over a month, and I don't know how they managed it. But, you know, they had friends who assisted and, you know, continued to support them throughout this month-long series of quarantines that they imposed on themselves.
Presumably dropping food parcels through the windows and things like
that. Yeah, I mean, personally, I think it's child abuse. You know, she posted on her birthday that, you know, she was saddened that she wouldn't be able to hug all of her children on her birthday. This, none of it is government regulation. None of it is mandated. They are simply imposing these measures on themselves and on their children. And it seems completely unwarranted. In fact, it seems detrimental because, as I say, this psychology has the effect of not only something called a placebo effect, there is also something called a nocebo effect, which is the polar opposite of a placebo effect. So where you actually perceive harm where there is none. So an interview between Reiner Fomick, the German investigative committee and a French clinical psychologist, Dr. Ariane Bilharan, I'm not sure if that's how you pronounce her name, where they discussed this totalitarian drift that we seem to be wandering into. And she made a lot of points, and they were all very interesting, and I'll try and summarize some of it here. But she basically says that, and this is one of her, you know, principal focuses in her practice is psychopathology and harassment and so on. So she says totalitarian ideology needs to create a false belief which usurps reality. It is a delusion that does not match reality, which is based on lived experiences. So, you know, that really, that's what we are living in, is a delusion. She says we're in a collective delusion. And this psychopathological delusion creates a new reality based on a false narrative which replaces existing reality. So the new reality is that, you know, we are in a completely new reality, a new situation, because, you know, we are faced with a novel deadly virus. That is the new reality that they seeded at the beginning of 2020. And because of the way that they delivered this new reality via a series of threats and terror, as in, you know, millions will die sort of terror, that facilitated the contagion of delusion. So this delusion is actually contagious, and many people are susceptible to it. So this is, again, why she says she's in agreement with Professor Desmet, the other psychologist who has talked about the formation of mass psychology, you know, this mass psychosis, as it were. And so she goes on to explain that totalitarian regimes are based on some key mental pathologies, which are a psychosis of paranoia, perversion, and psychopathy. So she focused mainly on this concept of psychosis of paranoia, which she describes as being under a delusion of persecution. So I think if I understood her correctly, she explained that right now there are two key delusions of persecution. And she said that many of the oligarchy of the 0.1% suffer a delusion of persecution. They have a paranoia. Their paranoia is, and their fear of persecution is, they believe they are persecuted by we the people. And her hypothesis is that people in their position who have maybe gained their position via, you know, maybe they have committed bad deeds, or they have done wrong in order to accrue the levels of power and wealth that they have, they experience a sense of, she says, anguish. But, you know, perhaps there's a sense of guilt and anguish that they have committed wrong in order to gain the levels of power and influence and wealth that they have.
Well, you know what, I've heard this also referred to as imposter syndrome. So the idea that people haven't actually got the skills and the qualifications and the ability to do these powerful jobs that they've been appointed to.
Yeah. Well, she aptly sums it up as totalitarianism is the reign of corruption and the reign of mediocre people. The totalitarian regime persecutes real experts. It does not want them. So yes, I think that's true. I mean, if you look at, well, the royal family, for example, you know, how did they, you know, why do they deserve to be in that position of power? And, you know, again, people like Bill Gates, who have no, university degrees that they've gained through their own merit, you know, their honorary degrees that he's got. Again, people like the chap pushing the PCR, who in fact created the supposedly gold standard of PCR tests, Christian Drosten in Germany. You know, there is debate. There are now investigations into his supposed qualifications, because,
well, look, I don't want to open a can of worms here, but you know, we've got these programs, haven't we, the Rhodes Scholarships and the Yale World Fellows, for example, Bristol's Blairite Mayor Marvin Rees, whose father was actually a criminal and involved in destroying the anti-apartheid movement in the city. He, back in the 1980s, late 80s, early 90s, was made a Yale World Fellow. And also the woman, I can't remember her name, who's the chief scientific advisor or medical advisor to the Scottish government. She's also
one of these
programs. This is the woman that went on to Newsround on the BBC Children's TV, telling the children that the vaccines were 100% safe and there'd been no injuries at all of anyone in America.
Right, yeah. Debbie, what's her name? Yeah, I know the one you mean. And you know, there are many of them, but so that they suffer under a delusion of persecution, which may or may not be justified, but they're constantly terrified of being found out, of losing their grip on power. So therefore they turn the persecution around onto their perceived enemy, which is us. And so their means of persecuting us is justified to them, because they feel that we deserve it because we are the enemy. And so they will harass us.
The thing is, we're the enemy because we might potentially unveil them as incompetent, right. You know, and they know they're incompetent. They're constantly living in fear of this, of reality starting to bite.
Yes, indeed. And so it's kind of a vicious, you know, it's a vicious cycle in a way, but the harassment comes in many forms, manipulation of emotions, intimidation, blackmail, terror, And it's this harassment, which is the actual keystone of paranoid psychosis. It's what makes it work. Without this constant harassment, people, us, we wouldn't fall into the trap. We wouldn't become deluded ourselves. Because the intimidation, you know, if for example, at the beginning of this whole scandemic, they had said quite calmly, well, you know, citizens of this country, you know, there appears to be something circulating in China. It doesn't appear to be terribly contagious. So we will just maintain vigilance, but, you know, let's carry on as normal, and we will all be, you know, we will all make sure that we are duly diligent. And they kept everything transparent, and they kept everyone well informed, but in non-hysterical terms, and treated it as though it were completely manageable, and did not, you know, shut down any dissent, did not smear anybody challenging them, and, you know, allowed for treatments to be tried and shared knowledge about treatments and so on. You know, this would not have happened. You know, people would not have been in fear of their lives. They would not have begun to point fingers at others as being unclean and so on, unhygienic. And this delusion would not have been created, but clearly.
Well, hang on, because don't forget, Tess Laurie in Bath has suggested that she reckons that roughly 60,000 people died unnecessarily because the government, the Department for Health and the pharmaceutical industry just refused to admit there was any treatment.
Right. I mean, they needed the mortality figures to justify their definition that this was a deadly novel virus. You know, we know coronavirus is novel. So it's quite, you know, it's quite ironic that they chose something as well known in scientific studies and scientific literature as, you know, the family known as coronaviruses. You know, as Mike Eden has said, they are all part of a family, and there is nothing novel about them. So, yeah, they had to bulk up these mortality figures because they had predicted astronomical mortality figures with the equally incompetent Neil Ferguson, another mediocre character. So this harassment, this reign of terror, which harms people, is deliberate, because these people who suffer paranoid delusions of persecution feel persecuted and therefore are retaliating against us, the enemy. There are people who are not paranoid, they are not as deluded, but who participate in the corruption, in the crises, and in the totalitarian system. And these people are described as perverts, according to her definition in her talk. So I don't know if that's a psychological term or whether it's a translation issue, but anyways, she describes them as perverts who pervert the system. And she goes on to talk about the overriding psychopathy. But there is, of course, another delusion that the people fear, that is, those of us who do not feel that, you know, we are not the oligarchy. The masses of people around us experience a a delusion of persecution. And initially, our delusion is based on this virus. So we feel, because that this is what was seeded, this narrative, this false narrative that was seeded, was that we were being persecuted by a deadly virus. So our collective delusion is that we are being attacked from outside by a virus. And then eventually that enemy is redirected toward the other, the individual, the people who refuse to be vaccinated or do not go along with a COVID pass, as described by that clearly psychotic individual in the Northern Territories of Australia, Michael Gunner, is that his name? Who, you know, whose video clip went viral recently, where he was ranting and raving about the fact that even if you had the vaccine, if you are anti-COVID pass or anti-mandatory vaccines, you are anti-vax. That was what he was ranting and raving about. So, you see, there is no mercy, you know, for the other. The other is stigmatized, is that the sacrifice of the other becomes completely justified to the people who suffer from delusions of persecution.
Well, the obvious thing to bring up here is the Jews in the 1930s Nazi Germany.
Yes, and she brings this up in her talk, is that they were blamed for spreading typhus. And you know, of being unclean. And so this is the same, you know, it's history repeating itself, and people feel very resistant to using those sorts of comparisons, because clearly those of us that refuse to be jabbed are not of a single race or ethnicity or religious belief. We are very diverse. But nevertheless, people who are unwilling to take an experimental medical intervention are being demonized. And however, you know, there, as you say, there are positive, lots of positive you know, movements and actions and activities going on. And again, the general sort of feedback and comments in mainstream articles. For example, there was an article not so long ago at the beginning of this month, I think, in the Daily Mail, that, you know, British politicians were considering making boosters mandatory for travel in the not too distant future, which would make all the people who have been double jabbed once again in a position of not being able to travel because they need to get the third jab. So, you know, the comments, I think there were about 7,000 comments, if I'm not mistaken, on that Daily Mail article. And most of them were basically opposing what was going on. They were clear, they clearly seemed to be awake to this, you know, what's basically being exposed as a massive fraud. And so that's a positive sign. And another positive sign, you know, again, is this the new book out by Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., about the real Anthony Fauci, apparently is rapidly creeping up the charts and could very well be an Amazon blockbuster for Thanksgiving, number one bestseller. And, you know, so there is a hunger, I think, now among even the people who've been jabbed to know what the hell is going on. Why the hell have they gone along with all of this and done all the right things and been a good citizen, and yet they're still not good enough. You know, that they may still not be allowed to go anywhere if they don't get the booster, and things are still not back to normal. And the same story keeps repeating itself with, you know, rising cases. And again, this fear constantly being drip fed in the media. These are positive signs, I think.
It'd be interesting to see what happens with this Swiss referendum. Although I'm quite concerned. I mean, I could almost predict. I noticed that the idea of this vaccine passport for Switzerland has also been, they've sweetened it with the pill of massive amounts of money. So I don't know quite how they've, it could be, say, that, for example, an international organization like the IMF has come to the Swiss government and said, well, if you have this vaccine passport, you can have all these extra loans. But the Swiss are saying that there will be a massive amount of extra money for healthcare in Switzerland if people have their vaccine passports. So that, for a start, is just as part of the referendum decision that people are making, seems to be basically a bribe. But there's also the key matter in Switzerland of, as everywhere else, this is a fairly short term election referendum campaign over there. And the media is likely to swing people or sway people one way or another in this. And it's if the pharmaceutical industry has got, you know, it's lobbying tendrils into the media and into the government in Switzerland, it does seem that that it's a slam dunk, basically, that the Swiss people have got to be pretty smart to get on top of the propaganda and see through it and vote against the vaccine passports there.
Yes, well, I hope so. I mean, what you say is very true. There is a doctor who is part of the Doctors for COVID Ethics Group, Dr. Thomas Binder, who has been doing an enormous amount of work in trying to get the message out, to work with colleagues across the medical sector and to really inform and educate. I think they do have, you know, I mean, Switzerland is unique in that there are, I think, four national languages, you know, it's a diverse community. So yes, in terms of getting the message out, you know, sharing the information with everyone, making sure that anybody you know who has contacts in Switzerland or who has Swiss citizenship gets to find out and gets to vote and to vote no on this referendum, no to the COVID pass, regardless of the bribes that may or may not be in place. It is absolutely key. So yeah, all hands on deck to that one. But of course, we must also keep trying to, you know, reach out to people and educate them. And one idea I had, which I'm not sure if it's going to be successful, if it's actually going to work out, but I suggested that the Doctors for COVID Ethics, for instance, could perhaps draft a sort of almost like a personal letter outlining all the facts that they know about this scamdemic, which they can back up with references and links, but mainly a sort of a letter to inform in not too many words so that it's not too laborious to read through, which people could then copy and paste into emails to their friends and families and contacts as a way of sort of reaching them and hoping, you know, in an effort to sort of reach out to them and say, look, don't take my word for it. Here's a email from, you know, these doctors who've signed this letter directly to you. I don't know. It's an idea, and I hope it might take off, and I hope it works. It could then be shared, in group email formats and Telegram groups and various social media platforms. Because I think, you know, many of us have the experience of trying to get through to family and friends and colleagues and so on, and just hitting a brick wall. You know, they say, well, send us links, you know, and maybe in the early days they said, send us links, we'll read them. But then they started vetting those links and saying, oh, wow, that's from Children's Health Defense. They're anti-vax. So they immediately kind of refused to engage with the information because they didn't like where it was coming from. So that's one thing that I'm hoping to get off. But finally, in this discussion between Raina Formic and this clinical psychiatrist in France, they asked, who are the people who do not fall into this collective delusion, and why is it that they do not? And she outlined it very simply in five aspects to the reasons or the types of individuals who do not fall into the delusion. And number one, she says, people who have a sense of autonomy and individualism and are able to isolate themselves from groups. So from the beginning of their psychological development, they are able to distinguish their own identity from a group identity. That's number one. Number two are people who accept finitude, so the sense of finiteness, the sense of their own limitation within time and within space. So you know what you are permitted to do on an individual level. You know what your personal limits are. You know that you are not going to live forever, that, you know, we all eventually die. And she goes on to explain that transhumanism, which she believes is an extension of Nazi ideology or eugenics ideology, is obsessed with immortality, because those in a totalitarian collective delusion cannot or do not accept their own limitations. You know, they have a grandiose sense of their own powers and mortality. Number three is those people who are grounded in truth and morality. And that is key, because we cannot have any justice if we do not seek the truth. So that is very important, to be grounded in truth and in morality. And number four is the ability to overcome trauma, the capacity to overcome trauma. So this is a traumatic experience. However, ironically, those who persecute us, those who traumatize us, they are deliberately traumatizing the people. However, they minimize it. They say, oh, it's okay, it's not that bad. It's for the common good. So, you know, there's a dichotomy there where you're being traumatized and yet they are minimizing it. And I think many people now who are suffering severe adverse reactions are experiencing this. You know, their experiences are being minimized and they're being told, well, you're just, you know, just be quiet. We don't want to hear from you. So the people who are able to see through the delusion are able to overcome trauma. And finally, the fifth point is to be grounded in reality. So even though you may not have, you know, you're a lay person, let's say you don't have any training in science, in virology, in immunology, but your feet are firmly planted in reality. So she gave an example, let's say, of a person who is loaded down with doctorate degrees, and they make a claim. They tell you that plants benefit from being fed with petroleum. So to stop watering them, but to start feeding them petroleum, but that is better for them. Now, someone who is grounded in reality will know, even though they don't understand the science behind it, they will know that clearly that is wrong, that, you know, that would kill the plant. So, you know, these were the five key points to explain those who are not susceptible to these sorts of mass formations, collective delusions, and paranoias of persecution.
Well, I mean, I can remember when this all first started, maybe a few weeks afterwards, I suddenly spotted on my bookshelf Wilhelm Reich's Mass Psychology of Fascism and brought that out. And I should probably read it from cover to cover, but I had a few dips into there. And it was certainly, you know, he was coming up with similar ideas, such as this idea of the mass delusion, absolutely key to, you know, a wicked government, whatever you want to call them, tyrants or whatever, deliberately, you know, trying to accrue more and more power to themselves, dissolve any ability of citizens to resist that, and to so that, you know, basically a kind of back to a kind of medieval style of running the show. But look, a couple of things you said there, which are to do with truth and morality, your third category, and the fifth one, people grounded in reality. Surely, you know, we're living in an age now where it's very difficult to say what is the truth and, you know, what is reality. And certainly what with the mass media out there, there is an enormous amount of ability to twist and turn reality into something else. It seems to me there's an attempt to impose this alternate reality on us, but it's actually very, very successful. And anyway, who am I to say, who are you to say that it's not true?
Well, yeah, and I agree, you know, this harassment that we're facing, it composes a distinct psychological aspect of it. I mean, most of it is a sort of mental trauma, mental and emotional trauma. And so it's a manipulation. And many people who have suffered under narcissistic abuse by a partner, for example, have identified it. They, you know, they can see that the behavior by governments and other institutions are akin to a narcissistic abusive partner. You know, it's difficult because I perceive a deliberate attempt to undermine truth, just natural law, and the things that people for millennia have held to be true. For instance, and I may get shot down by some of your listeners about this, but, you know, I think the flat earth thing is a complete psyop in order to deliberately undermine people who are naturally critical thinkers and who question everything. And, you know, wherever you go these days, there seems to be someone banging on about, you don't know the truth until you go to this website and find out for yourself about the nature of the universe and that the planet that we live on is in fact flat. I mean, that, and immediately then, you know, the whole thread just falls apart. And so, you know, subsequently, of course, you'll find that the status quo now regularly, frequently uses the jibe or the terminology flat earther to equate with anyone who challenges any status quo, whether it's about vaccines, whether it's about allopathic medicine, whether it's about climate, whether it's about anything, you know, gender and so on. So you really, I think, I'm not saying I have a divining rod for truth, but I think what we have to be aware of is that in order to keep us controlled, they have to manipulate us into thinking certain ways. And they deliberately use emotive subjects and emotive language. So, you know, anything that drives fear, anything that drives terror or guilt, or, and on the positive side, things that incline you towards being empathetic. They manipulate those feelings. If you feel you're being manipulated, you know, be aware. And when you look at information, ask why this is coming out at that point. Ask who benefits from this information being spread. For example, you know, recently a few people shared an article in The Guardian, an op-ed piece, that claimed, you know, the hospitals were full of unvaccinated people. So this recent piece in The Guardian, apparently from an anonymous consultant in a hospital, claiming that the hospitals were full, their hospital was full of unvaccinated people, and that, you know, they're really losing patients with people who choose not to be vaccinated. When you read these sorts of emotive pieces, ask yourself, why are they saying this? Is it true? What are the facts? Who does this benefit? What is the motive?
Well, I suppose, you know, when you're talking about is it true, we've got something like 95% vaccination in Britain now. So the chance of hospitals being full with the unvaccinated is pretty slim. And I think the other big advantage that people like you and I have, Catherine, over the producers and the editors of the TV news, is that what we say does hang together and make sense, because there's some horrific flaws in the, you know, in the other side's arguments. And this, I suppose, is what exposes it for me anyway, is that it just doesn't add up. Much of it doesn't add up.
Oh, the glaring inconsistencies. Yes, I mean, there are loads of glaring inconsistencies. I mean, for example, even, you know, when they impose lockdowns of people who haven't been jabbed, for example, in Austria, you know, and yet those people are allowed to go to work and go to school. But then as soon as they finish those activities, they must quarantine. So does that mean that they are absolutely not infectious? You know, they're not dangerous to those who have been jabbed while they're at work, while they're at school, but they are dangerous in their leisure time? You know, that's kind of weird. And then what about, you know, those timed curfews? Oh, you know, the vaccine is rampaging around town after 10 o'clock at night and, you know, until 5 o'clock in the morning. But, you know, the rest of the day it's sleeping. So don't worry. You know, you can go out and about during the day. Or how about, you know, people who are unjabbed must only buy essential goods. They, you know, it's forbidden to buy unessential goods. So you can't buy children's clothing, winter jackets and toys and so on. You're allowed to buy food, however. Or when you go into a restaurant, you can walk in with a mask on, but sit down and eat and chat and laugh and cough and cry and spit at your table without the mask on. But as soon as you stand up and walk out, you've got to put your mask back on. I mean, yeah, like you say, there's just...
Yes, and if you want to go to the toilet, you've also got to put your mask on for that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there is, and then, you know, sitting in crowded airplanes, you can eat and drink with your mask off, but as soon as you finish eating and drinking, you've got to put your mask back on because, you know, while you're eating, there is no danger, but while you're just sitting quietly, sleeping or snoozing, you must have your mask on. I mean, it's just, none of it makes sense. Zero amount. I mean, there is literally, I can't think of a single thing that they say that makes any sense whatsoever. And on top of that, you and I, Tony, we aren't being funded by Bill Gates, are we? I mean, we have no skin in the game. I'm not getting even a penny from anyone at this stage for anything that I say. So take it or leave it. I could be talking utter twaddle, but, you know, it's no skin off my nose if you believe it or not.
Well, yeah, I think it's absolutely fascinating that you've got this situation where people who aren't actually very intelligent and aren't able to see these contradictions are the victims. I mean, it just seems almost like a way of abusing or making in a way a bit like you were saying initially about this idea of people who are in power being imposters. The same sort of thing is going on through the rest of society. So intellectuals, anyone who's actually able to rationalize these things and get on top of them and say, well, hang on, that doesn't make sense. That's a kind of tyrannical statement. They are demonized. And the people who just kind of go along with anything without really thinking about it or don't have the mental ability to rationalize things, they are seen as the brilliant ones and the successful ones. But anyway, look, I think that'll do for this week, Catherine, unless there's anything else you want to say. Is there?
Well, no, just for your last point, I think, you know, I mean, I agree. And I think, you know, I'm just completely dumbfounded why, you know, perfectly intelligent people that I know are going along with it. I think initially, you know, they did. So they were really, really affected by the campaign of fear. So that, you know, that in that sort of external threat, which was deliberate, of course, the narrative of fear, that really affected them. And so that immediately was a psychological hook. And that hook is replayed again and again whenever the threat levels go up. And, you know, it's going to be very difficult for them to untangle themselves from that initial fear that was triggered. But also, I think they fall into the category, which, you know, in normal, peaceful times where, you know, democratic processes are the norm and where, you know, the government is held to account and is relatively transparent and so on, you know, the collective good is not necessarily always a bad thing. So they tend towards, and then generally the progressive left and so on, tend towards a concept of the collective good. And so they are trapped in this, which was the first point of this clinical psychologist, is the individual who doesn't fall into a delusion is able to distinguish themselves, isolate themselves from the group, and has a sense of autonomy. Now, in you know, progressive circles, those people might be identified as being selfish, individualistic, when things are going well. But when things are going badly, those very same people are actually the ones who stand apart and go, no, no, hang on, guys. Your concept of collective good is actually going to the extremes and is generating more harm than good. And so I think those are the two key things where these intelligent people that we know are trapped. And they haven't yet witnessed the overall harms, the, you know, because they're not being covered in the news and in the mainstream, the tremendous harms that are being caused by these measures.
Well, there's a deeper thing, I think, which is Wilhelm Reich touches on back in, you know, in his study of what happened in Nazi Germany in the 30s, which is, you know, this actual yearning for collective good that's out there, because, you know, there is this tremendous potential out there in society, which is largely kept back by the shadow of big business being cast over society, you know, aspirations being squashed of small businesses by big chains and mega corporations. You know, lots of, so many people have been put out of business just in the last couple of years by the pandemic. But there is a genuine yearning out there for collective good. And it's now suddenly the government, the TV, the pharmaceutical industry has come along with a, hey, we've got something which is at last is going to be the collective good.
Yeah. Yeah. A real coming together in a crisis. Yeah. No one, you know, everybody has warm and fuzzy feelings, you know, looking back. Almost with rose-tinted views about the way people come together in adversity. And we hear about it, you know, from people who lived through the wars and so on. And, you know, you experience it whenever there's a local event that is destructive. For example, when, you know, the area of Gloucester and Tewkesbury was flooded in 2007. Our own home was flooded. And, you know, that sense of camaraderie that, you know, you experience in adversity, where your neighbors, who you never ever visited previously and merely ever only said hello across the garden fence, finally invite you into their home for a cup of tea and maybe a bite to eat, because you actually can't sit in your own house and have a cup of tea and something to eat. You know, that, yeah, obviously it's great when it all comes together. But then after a while, we all find that, you know, we get a bit fed up of rubbing along with everybody else and we like our own space. And so that all falls apart. And I think that has fallen apart, you know, in this in this last two years, you know, the initial outpouring of support for all the people isolating at home, all the poor, elderly, vulnerable people who must be so lonely, and who's doing their shopping for them, and let's go and get stuff for them and bring it to their doorstep, you know, and wave through the window and say, hey, how are you? We're looking out for you. That appears to have evaporated.
Okay, Catherine. Well, Catherine Gunn, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony.